And welcome to another edition of Stormy Weather, news from the frontline in the end times. This week I'll be talking again with Kerry McCoy. Specifically, by special request, we'll be discussing Kerry's messiah complex, his encounters with alien beings, and his very unusual dream life. Are you there, Kerry? Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Welcome back to Stormy Weather.
Thank you.
Talking earlier in private about your dream life, I was wondering if you could share a little bit of that with our listeners. Do you have an internal dialogue when you dream?
Not that I recall.
Have you ever sat down to meditate in a dream?
No. That's one of the things, you know, that I wanted to try to do, but it just doesn't seem to come up in the dream, you know. I was thinking, you know, wouldn't it be neat to be in a lucid dream and decide to lay down and have a dream in the dream?
Well, that's one of the gates of dreaming. And that's happened to me many times. And the trick is, to really get into another dimension, another reality, is you have to lie down in your dreaming body, in the dream, in the exact same position that you're lying in your bed. Apparently, that's the trick.
Huh. That's very interesting.
And I've done that unconsciously. I didn't think I'm going to do this now, but I've dreamt of lying down in a dream, and sure enough, as soon as I lie down in the dream and close my eyes, I enter into another dream instantly. And it's totally real. The dream I enter into is far more real than the dream that I just exited. So it's like one's level of awareness just shifts by this act of lying down.
Right. I'm hoping that as I get older, and my sex drive diminishes, that the focus in my dreams will change to something of more substance than, you know, just meeting up with beautiful women.
I don't think it works that way, because your sex drive won't diminish if you keep on handling awareness as a sorcerer. Your sex drive will just increase.
I have a lot of very bizarre dreams that have left an impression on me for years, and not necessarily lucid dreams, vivid dreams.
Like visions?
Not visions, but just very, very vivid dreams, you know? But I wasn't necessarily in control of them, like a lucid dream. I had one dream where I was sitting outside at my grandparents' old house where they used to live where I would hang out when I was real young, and there was a UFO battle in the sky. And these UFOs were shooting each other down, and there was just all kind of commotion going on, and everybody was freaking out. But anyway, these three guys showed up, and whenever they showed up, they had like this vacuum. That's another thing in my dreams. It's like the pressure changes. I notice in my dreams a lot that the pressure changes. There's like a vacuum or something will come over me. And anyway, there's like these three wise men that came to anoint me. So it's kind of making me like the Christ sort of figure. And but they were just decked out in jewels, just head to toe, and they were black as night. I mean, all three of them were huge, incredibly dark black men. I don't know what we did. We had some type of mental exchange, and one of these UFOs that exploded in the sky, the fragments landed all around us, and they looked like glowing pieces of cantaloupe. You know, they're kind of like that nice fleshy orange color.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody was running and freaking out, and I was telling everybody, you better pick it up and eat a piece. And everybody, not the wise men, of course, but everybody else, like the pedestrian traffic, whatever, was like, no way, man, you're crazy. And I was like, okay, maybe I am. And I picked it up, and I started eating it. And apparently, I don't know, you can read a lot into that symbolism. It tied into an actual experience that I had as a child. And this experience is really interesting because I've remembered it as an adult after I had this dream. But as a child, I was sitting outside of my grandparents in the back of a pickup bed, and I had just gotten some headphones, and I had this tape. It was a Spider-Man kind of a comic book that came with an audio tape, and the whole thing was about Draco.
Draco, like the constellation.
Right. But anyways, that really happened when I was a child, I think. I mean, who knows? But anyways, this dream kind of tied it back into that day. I think, as far as I can recall, maybe completely crazy, I think that really happened when I was a child, that I actually sat out there that day and listened to that tape, and it gave me goosebumps, you know, it just kind of gave me the chills. But then in the dream as an adult, I was sitting in the pickup truck, and I don't remember if I was a child or an adult body, but that's when the three wise men, or whatever they were, showed up and kind of got around me, and, you know, we had some type of mental exchange, and I don't know what they were doing. I say anoint. I don't know what that means. Whatever.
Anoint means to cover with oil.
Yeah, well, it wasn't covering me with oil. It was more like I was getting some type of blessing or approval. And so anoint to me, it doesn't really mean covered with oil. It's just a blessing or approval from them.
Well, you know that's what the meaning of Christ, right?
What's that?
Anointed.
Yeah. Well, I don't really think that it's covering in oil necessarily.
Well, it's a symbolic thing, the oil.
Right.
So, but was that around about the time of your Messiah complex, or was this later?
Oh, no, I mean, the Messiah complex thing comes and goes. You know, it never really goes away completely. You know, I'll have real life things that happen, and then dream things that happen to kind of bring it up again.
Can you remember when it started, though, this idea, when it first came to you?
When I was about 10 or 11, I actually had like a real life UFO encounter with my brother and a neighbor, where we were sitting on the sidewalk, and I looked up and saw a big silver disc, and it was just kind of hovering there for a while, and then it disappeared. The whole day was very strange. I don't remember exactly what happened. I brought it up a lot later, and the details just get weirder and weirder. And weirder. And they continue to get weirder, because I still haven't dropped it. I'm always bugging my parents and stuff about the details of that day.
So you mean the details that other people bring up?
Right. Yeah, because it wasn't just me that saw it.
Mm.
And apparently my sister was playing outside. She was freaked out. And then my mom was outside too. And they all have different stories. And they didn't seem to remember any of the stuff when I was young and would talk about it. This is just like 5 or 6 years ago, my mom actually came out and said she remembered something happening that day. She's been repressing it and didn't want to talk about it, or either, you know, there's like some type of mental viral infection that I'm spreading to everyone else, causing them to have false memories. I mean, I've explored all the strange possibilities, so, you know, I don't know what's going on. Back to the beginning of the Messianic complex, but shortly after that, I began to have, you know, really bizarre dreams. And they all seem to revolve around me being separate and special from everyone else. And one of the main dreams that I actually vividly recall, like the typical big-eyed grays that are everywhere in the media right now, it was a really interesting dream. I was in my house that I grew up in as a child, and I was completely alone. And everything was stripped out of the house. It was just like it was a brand new house, and it still had concrete floors, and nothing had been put in it yet. But I was the only person in the house, and when I looked outside the windows, these alien grays were just all over the place, just like literally like insects, and they all had these big syringes, and they were injecting everyone. And I knew that they couldn't get me. They had gotten everyone else in the world, and now they were all focused on me. But they couldn't get me for some reason, so they surrounded the house, and in the dream, they were all just piled up against the house and looking in the windows, just waiting for something to happen. And I just kind of got down on the floor in one of the corners, in like one of the only spots where I couldn't really see the windows, because I didn't even want to look at them anymore.
Right.
So that's kind of like a beginning of me being kind of singled out and separate.
Was that before the Greys were well known?
Yes, that was far before they were well known.
So in fact you didn't recognize them in the dream as anything? That was like the first time you'd been exposed to that imagery?
Yeah. And I didn't get into this, you know, reading a whole lot of paranormal alien stuff until I was well into my 20s.
Alright, so what, 10 years later even?
Yeah, so it would be about 10 or 12 years later.
Did you, were you aware in the dream of what was happening to the people who were being injected?
Yes, they were basically, they were all being turned into just mindless zombies. They weren't killing them, but everybody was just walking around in this utter stupor.
Mm.
Just, they were just dazed.
Because, you know, my first real dream experience of aliens and about greys, at least that I remembered, was much later in life when I was in my 20s, and it entailed, part of the dream entailed these beings going around injecting everyone, and they're injecting people in the back of the neck, and I actually woke up feeling a needle going into the back of my neck. It was as real as if it was actually happening. I mean, so it made a big impression waking up. But also in the dream, there was also this element that they were turning people not so much into zombies but into robots.
Yeah, same thing.
Mm.
You know, just they don't really have, well, I don't know, critical thinking.
Right.
And then I had another dream that I still remember, where I was in this place, and this place was like hell, and but all of the people were still, they acted exactly the way they did, the way the people who had been injected acted. They were those zombie people, basically. Mm-hmm. And I was in this space, and it was just filled with the zombie people. And they just walked around aimlessly.
And what were you doing?
Watching them. Now this ties into another dream that's very similar. And this dream, I'm in a desert, and I'm surrounded by the zombie people. You know, and the desert is just huge, it's expansive, you can see, just, you know, for miles and miles and miles, and it's just filled with people, and it's the zombie people, and they're just walking around doing nothing, you know, just totally mindless, and the ground starts to churn and spin, and it starts, and like the ground starts to turn into like quicksand, sort of, and it starts to pull them under, and they all start screaming and stuff, and it's just this terrible scene. But the ground right under my feet where I'm standing starts to rise up, and it rises up maybe 100, 200 feet up in the air. So I'm way up in the air, and I can see, again, and there's this weird thing where I can actually see the curvature of the earth, and it just kind of goes on infinite, and there's just people dying and sucked into the earth everywhere, and I'm so overwhelmed by the scene, I can't do anything, and I'm just, I don't know, screaming.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to save them, and then these angels appear, and I think they kind of look like typical angels, you know, they have the white flowy garments or whatever, and they're antagonizing me. They kind of are being, you know, smart asses, and they're going, okay, save them, you want to save them, go ahead, all you gotta do is just speak or something, you know, say the word, save them. And when I start to scream or try to speak to save them, blue flames and sparks come out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And I just scream and scream and try to save all these people, or zombies or robots or whatever they are, and the blue flames just keep coming out of my mouth.
Mm-hmm.
And they're just, and it seems like they're delighted by it.
The angels.
Yeah. Kind of like, you just don't get it, do you, dummy? That's kind of the, I don't know, even after all these years, that's the feeling that I got from them.
What is it that you don't get?
I don't know.
What are you saying?
I have no idea.
You've refrained from trying to interpret it, huh?
No, I have, but the only interpretations that I really come up with are just bad. You know, if you just try to block it out. I mean, is humanity doomed? Is that what the obvious interpretation would be?
Well, except that that's got nothing to do with you, does it, really? I mean, it's your dream, so what's it mean for you personally would be the way you want to start, I think.
Hmm.
Rather than, I mean, you kind of, if you're seeing it as a prophetic vision, then that's a whole different framework, isn't it? And basically it's a dream with a specific message for you.
Right, whether I'm looking at it personally or impersonally, I guess, a good way to say that, right?
Yeah, or archetypally. I mean, those are the three different levels, and I think we've always got to start with the personal, because that's where we are, isn't it? Most of the time, we're in the personal.
Yeah. Well, you know, I've had a lot more interesting encounters with the aliens, too. We've had some interesting interactions. I've been grappling with the idea of the aliens. I don't know if I should perceive them as essentially doctors who are trying to give me something that's good for me that I don't really want. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of like making a kid eat broccoli. You know, he thinks you're torturing him. He's terrible. You know, he can just cry and throw a fit or whatever.
Sure, when you take a cat to the vet, you know.
Yeah. Or, you know, even if they are doing something good for me, I mean, cattlemen do stuff that's, you know, good for the cattle all the time. That doesn't necessarily mean that they really have their welfare at heart. You know what I mean?
Sure.
I mean, yeah, you want to keep the cows healthy until they go to slaughter. So I consider that too, you know. But the reality is, I just don't know. And so I have my perspective in the way I interact with them whenever I do see them in dreams changes. And I've noticed that I have been able to actually hold one down and punch him in the face. I did. I mean, I don't recall the circumstances, but that part stuck with me when I woke up. All I remember was taking one down and punching him in the face, and all of the others were just freaking out.
How are they behaving? Like running around, like throwing their hands in the air?
No, they don't really move. They're just stunned, and you can't feel them change. You know, they don't have any emotions. But you can feel, it's like you can kind of feel their psychology change. It's kind of like, you know, you ever heard a beehive? When you shake it up and it goes, it's like their minds make, it's like a vibration, and it goes up, and it's like an agitated vibration.
Huh.
And, you know, this is all telepathic that I'm getting from.
Yeah.
But I thought it was interesting, and I don't know if I really even wanted to, you know, it's not like I'm going to escape them. You can't escape these guys, obviously. I mean, once they're in your shit, they're always in your shit.
Well, what do you think their interest in you is, then? Have you got a sense of that?
No, I mean, they may be interested in everybody. They may be doing this to everybody. And I'm just, for some reason, you know, I don't think I'm the only person who's remembering this stuff. I mean, clearly a lot of people are. But, I mean, there could be millions and millions of people who actually wake up, remember this type of stuff, but they just don't talk about it at all.
Yeah, of course.
So I don't know how isolated or special this kind of thing makes me, really. But anyways, I mean, I've experimented with you know, actually trying to physically beat them up, you know, and rattle
them. Is that because you're afraid of them or angry or just as an experiment?
I'm just playing around with it. I really don't know.
So when you have these experiences, do they feel real at the time?
Well, yeah, in the dreams they feel real.
But they're not particularly frightening?
Not really. I don't frighten easily in my dreams. I've noticed that. Like I said before, I don't care in my dreams. You know what I mean? I just don't get scared. You can come at me, you know, and chop me up. It doesn't matter. I just reassemble. It doesn't matter. You know, I'm like Neo in the Matrix, really, in my dreams. You know, in real life, I'm kind of timid to try to stay out of trouble. Except for, you know, of course, like we were talking about, when push comes to shove, I will act. You know, whereas most people will walk by and pretend like they didn't see anything.
Mm-hmm.
But in one of my dreams, I was introduced to alien royalty. I was introduced to, I guess she was, you know, you could look at her as the queen bee. You know, it was a female, and she, you know, I was someplace in like some royal house or whatever, and they were introducing me to her, but I felt more like a specimen, you know, kind of like the prize heifer. And I walked up to her and kind of kissed her. And had a nasty thought about her, and she was absolutely like flabbergasted, and everybody else was just like, oh my god, I can't believe you just did that.
When you say everybody else, you mean gray aliens?
Yeah.
They were also the gray. Is it always gray looking beings in your dreams?
No, not always.
Hmm.
There's another type, too, that I see. And interestingly enough, too, I've met the queen in my dreams of this other species. And it's one of the few times that I've seen them. They're like the warlord aliens, and they look really human, except they have pale yellow skin tones and really bright red frizzy, just crazy frizzy hair.
Hmm.
And their eyes aren't quite right.
So why did you say they're the warlords?
I don't know. Because when I was in this dream, I was already a prisoner of war. It's like I kind of took over a body that was a prisoner of war, and they were all lined up against the wall with their hands tied behind their back, and this kind of authority figure, queen, female, that I had described, you know, she's very sexy, except for her kind of pale yellow skin, and I think they have, their teeth are kind of weird, you know, shark-like teeth, and something strange with their eyes, but she's basically walking down the line of prisoners and scanning all of their minds. And after she does a quick mind scan, the soldiers behind her just execute everybody, you know, just bam, bam. And so she's walking down this long line of people, giving them all individual mind scans. And when she's about four or five people down from me, I'm looking at her thinking about how hot and sexy she is. And while she's still scanning the few people in front of me, she starts to interact telepathically with me and reciprocates. And then whenever she gets to me, she stops and we have this kind of long telepathic exchange. And she bends down and gives me a kiss. And the kiss is so real in the dream that she has like these real fine crystal-like little hairs all over her face. They're a little bit thicker than hair, you know, but they're kind of crystal-like. And they kind of scrape my lips, and that sensation of it scraping on me wakes me up.
Hmm.
But it's weird because, you know, even though I had just popped into the body, I kind of knew the situation that was occurring on that planet. And on that planet, all of these people had been rounded up, and they had been conquered and overtaken by this other race, the Reds, I guess what you'd call them.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I have thought about it, and it does seem like, you know, through the dreams and all of the other encounters that I've had in my life, is that I am singled out somehow. There's something either strange about me, weird about me, I don't know what you want to say. I just don't really fit in at all.
But don't you think thousands, if not millions, of people feel that way? Without thinking that they're the Messiah, you know?
Right, yeah, I don't know.
So it's more than just not fitting in. There's something, and it's more than just feeling special, because everybody feels special, don't they, really, one way or another. So, I mean, what is it? What's that X factor that actually qualifies it as a Messiah complex, would you say?
Well, I don't really know. I mean, there are, you know, when I say Messiah complex, if that means the same thing that, you know, you kind of associate with, or anybody listening may think of when they say a Messiah complex. To me, a Messiah complex is kind of a superhero complex. It's not necessarily like you're the son of God, you know, like necessarily associated explicitly with Jesus, that type of Messiah. But it's just some type of superhero, sort of gotta save people, you know, at your expense sort of role, I guess, would be a messianic role to me.
The self-sacrifice?
Right. Essentially, I guess that would be a good way for me to put it, or that's how I think of a messianic complex, is sort of self-sacrifice for the good of the others.
Well, I was just listening to this astrologer a couple of days ago talking about the age of Pisces and how it's all sort of revolves around the idea of sacrifice, hence it was inaugurated by Christ and the crucifixion. And that's kind of the myth that we live by, and so we live in a time in which self-sacrifice is glorified as a virtue. So it sort of encourages the victim complex in people, this desire to play a victim.
Well, and
so it's the opposite of the hero. This is what is occurring to me, is that you first of all describe the Messiah as a superhero, and then you brought out the idea of self-sacrifice, which is common theme, isn't it, with the heroes and Spider-Man and Superman, that they have to sacrifice their own personal gain in order to assume responsibility for their power and use it to help others.
Right. So
they can't just be in it for themselves. But then it wouldn't really be a sacrifice, would it? It would be like a snake shedding its skin. That's not really a sacrifice, is it? That's just a process of growth necessary. Necessary letting go of the past in order to become something new.
Right.
But I mean, do you have heroic aspirations in your personal life?
No, and in fact, we had talked about this before. I try to hide.
Right.
Yeah, I don't want to be people's heroes. And there have been a couple of instances, you know, like when I was younger, we were skateboarding, and all the boys that I was with were had this great plan to catch this cat and stick a firecracker up its butt and light it, mm-hmm. you know. And everybody was going along with it, and when it finally came down to it, and they had actually caught the cat, and they were going to do this thing, you know, I just erupted like a volcano and threatened to beat everyone up, which I probably couldn't have done, but it was a good threat, and, you know, and let the cat go, and suffered the inevitable uncoolness and not having any friends.
As a result of that act of heroism, your friends dumped you after that?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, there's always a stigma with me that I was the uncool one who's going to spoil everyone's plans to either beat people up or maim animals. You know, I wasn't in the fun rape and pillage club, I guess what you could call it. A lot of the young kids are.
Was that a side of you that you hadn't seen before, that sort of intervening to come to the rescue?
I don't know if I had never seen it before. That's the first time it actually just full-on came out, you know. Yeah, but there's probably been other instances. One, when I was older, I was actually it was right at the end of high school, I think, either in my junior or senior year, a friend of mine was having a party, and some girl got totally drunk and passed out in a bedroom, and handful of guys or whatever thought it would be a good thing to just have like a kind of a gangbang with her since she was passed out. And apparently nobody was going to say anything to him or do anything because they were the tough thugs. And again, it was just like the cat incident where, you know, everybody's just going to stand around and look at their feet and act like it wasn't happening, and I had to explode and almost got my butt kicked. And I would have probably really got my ass kicked bad, except that it kind of forced the guy, the host, who was having the party, he actually had to go get a firearm and escort the other guys off the premises at gunpoint. So it was just a real fun situation. And then, of course, after that, I had to worry about, you know, the guys finding me someplace and kicking my ass.
Did you regret that act of heroism?
I don't really know. I don't regret it, nah. Because if I hadn't have done anything, I'd feel like a total... Because if I hadn't have done anything, she would have got, like, some kind of gangbang rape, and then... and then I'd feel like shit for the rest of my life for that.
Did you ever get any credit for it, or any gratitude?
Nope. I was just kind of in the middle of it. I was part of the problem, essentially.
So why would you be part of the problem?
Well, because, you see, that's kind of how it plays out, even in politics. I don't know if you've noticed, but the way it happens is the bullies do their thing, and everybody tries to ignore it and act like nothing's happening, right? Because they don't want to rock the boat or get involved in it. But then if someone does get involved in it and wants to stop things and tries to, you know, and makes a big scene out of it, and they have to get involved, well, then they resent you for that, too.
But surely not the victim of the gangbang wouldn't, in this metaphor.
This girl was wasted drunk. She had no... She still probably doesn't know what happened that night. So there's another little key of that messianic complex. And I mean, it's weird how it fulfills through time.
So how would it manifest in your life now? You know, what would you consider a heroic act that would be worth sacrificing your self-interest for? Is there an equivalent of that, like in the bigger picture? Because a Messiah, I mean, that's a pretty big role to play. I mean, even if it's not Christ, and even if you're saying that you don't feel that you're the Son of God, but maybe you're a Son of God, maybe.
No, I wouldn't even say that.
No? Like you're one of a special select few who've been given some special gift or power or knowledge?
In fact, I feel just the opposite. I feel like if anything, the special select few are probably the most evil fucking people in the world.
Well, no, I'm not talking about world. I mean, that's worldly power. I'm talking about so-called spiritual power.
I don't know. I really don't know.
Because, you said to me one time that you don't know anyone who is on your level, except maybe myself. that I was the first person you'd met that you considered maybe was on a level with you or even above you. So that means that you must feel that you're on a higher level than everyone else you know in terms of awareness.
Well, yeah, in terms of awareness. But that doesn't mean that there's not others out there.
Right.
I'm certainly not saying that you and I are like the only two people in the world. I mean, you have to remember that I grew up in Texas. So that's really not saying a lot.
You know? What I'm looking for is, you know, your take on this, whether you think that if people are people born equal, or are there a select few in this world, not necessarily chosen few or anything like that, but just that there's a limited number of people who have a disproportionate level of awareness or power or authority or whatever you want to call it, as compared to the rest of the population. Is that something that you believe?
Sure. I mean, I know that just by agreeing with it, you know, it's a setup for people to come back at you and say that you're some type of elitist nut job that thinks you've been singled out by God or whatever, because people are always going to read more into everything and they don't explore all the possibilities. That's one of the reasons I don't even like to talk about this kind of stuff, because people like to, like I say, split hairs and quantify and stick everything in mason jars and separate it all.
Well, sure, and including us, you know, we're people too, and that's the main reason I don't like to talk about it, is not because of what people will think or say, but because I feel that I'll be fixing something in some sort of rational framework that before I'm ready to, because I don't understand it either.
Yeah, and I don't understand it, and I don't like to talk about it because I can't possibly cover all the bases when I'm talking about it, and so I can't paint a full picture of the way I'm seeing things develop in my mind and how I perceive what's going on. I just can't do it justice in words. And I could sit here and go on and on and on and on for hours and keep going on tangents, but I'm still going to miss like a full spectrum.
But I mean, just say that, you know, just for the sake of argument, that there's a select few on this planet out of 6 billion individuals, and maybe it's not fixed. You know, maybe if there's 144,000 of these select few today, they're not written down in some book of light, because those 144,000 today won't be the same ones tomorrow. You know what I'm saying? Like it's some sort of meta-soul which can move and shift and morph and manifest through different individuals, depending on whether we're resonating to that consciousness. I mean, I'm just talking off the top of my head now. My only point was that out of 6 or 7 billion individuals, it's a very small percentage of that who are able to tune into the awareness of reality. Yeah? So, hypothetically, if that was the case, what do you think that these individuals that the chosen individuals, what would their function or purpose be?
Oh, I have no idea. I mean, I've thought about it. Like a good analogy is with like in beehives, they have what you call like a solitary bee, and the whole point of the solitary bee is to kind of scope out the area, because the rest of the hive is so busy doing what it's doing that if they didn't have the solitary bee out there scoping out the area, then I guess when they needed to move for whatever reason, I don't know the behavior of bees, so I hope nobody listens is going to go research this and come up with shit, you know, blah, blah, blah. But anyways, you know, so I kind of see myself as kind of like a solitary bee, you know. It's just basically my job just to poke around the outer limits.
Yeah.
Even though I don't, my rational mind and in my body, I may not bring it back and go and tell everybody what's going on, the data somehow is going into a central nexus.
Right.
You know, and it's going to ferment there for a while, I guess. Or until enough other solitary bees confirm
these new discoveries.
Right. Then, you know, it's kind of like what they call that 100th monkey syndrome or whatever, you know, where so many monkeys learn to wash fruit in a river and then before you know it, all of them are doing it, you know?
So then that would be like pioneers.
Yeah, more or less.
Those are discovering new lands.
Yes.
In order to bring back that knowledge to the tribe.
Right. And these new lands, of course, land being wholly symbolic, these new lands are just essentially, I really didn't know what to call them, really. they're not ideas, they're not places.
My new states of consciousness, maybe?
Yeah, there you go.
It would make sense that the pioneers would be solitary beings, as you've just described, that they would feel like outsiders, and obviously it would make sense because they're in the minority, but it would also make sense as part of their upbringing, their conditioning, that they would be conditioned, they would grow up in an environment in which they felt alienated and estranged, because that would be part of their function anyway, would be to go into strange lands where they're not recognized and where they don't recognize anything, and not to be discouraged by that feeling of being, you know, isolate and alone.
Right. Yeah, well, that would apply to me pretty well.
Mm-hmm.
My parents had a terrible marriage, fighting constantly and all that kind of stuff, and I did terrible in school, you know, terrible grades.
In psychology, you talk about when young children are in environments that they don't feel that they can connect to, they're not finding a connection, they will go off into the archetypal realms, and they will create a relationship with those realms, and they will create their own personal god and their own personal messiah complex as a way to have something to relate to. And when I say create, I don't mean that they're just making up in their minds. They are connecting to something that's real, but they're not necessarily ready to understand what it is, so they're actually creating their own, projecting their own version of it in order to find a refuge within that relationship. And so then that defines them thereafter. And so these are the children who then grow up with these very, they may be autistic in the sense that they're not socially very confident, but in their inner life they've got these very grandiose versions of reality and of themselves, not necessarily deluded, but they're kind of out of whack with their, you know, with their personas, with their public selves.
Yeah,
is that how you feel? Like your inner reality just is out of whack with your external reality?
Well, I think that really a good way to say it would be my inner reality is out of whack with everyone else's external reality in which I'm emerging. Yeah, I mean, I do what I do. I've always been, you know, the black sheep, and I just kind of forge my own path and do what I want to do. But, you know, I mean, you know, when I set foot out the front door, you know, I don't consider it to be my world. It, you know, it's not my country, it's not my city.
Sure, but I mean, it's your reality, isn't it? You know, I mean, you can look at it on the level of sociologically or mechanistically. You didn't create the society. You didn't have a hand in the way that society has come about. But and then again, you could look at it from the point of view of consciousness, and that you're shaping your experience of that reality through your consciousness, just like a lucid dreamer. So in that, to that, from that point of view, you have created your reality, you know. You've ended up where you've ended up. The circumstances of your reality are all the products of the decisions that you've made, no?
Sure.
Because you could be somebody totally different, living in a totally different part of the world in completely different circumstances. I mean, unrecognizably so, if you'd made different decisions.
Sure. I mean, decisions and chance, they both come together to put you where you are.
Yeah, well, chance is sort of a... Don't you think chance is a kind of just a word that we use without... It doesn't really have any meaning, because, I mean, is anything chance, really?
Well, you know, this is one of those philosophical-type debates that I find pointless these days.
Well, no, but I didn't come from the point of view of philosophy. I mean, scientifically speaking, is there anything chance of, you know, the behavior of atoms and the behavior of the celestial bodies? Is there any chance there? There doesn't seem to be, you know.
Right.
I mean, like, if you reach over and pick up a teacup and drink the tea, where's the element of chance in that, right?
Well, right, yeah, I agree with you on that.
So, really we act on decisions and we see them through, and then, okay, shit happens, sure, but it's still a result of our decision, because if we cross the road at the wrong moment and get hit by a bus, you could say that was bad luck, but you could also say, well, you made a decision to cross that street. Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah, I see what you're saying. If you want to take it there, then yeah. But I mean, you know, you can't say that if someone's driving home and they get hit by drunk drivers, that it was their decision to be driving in the first place was what caused them to get hit by a drunk driver.
Well, you can. You can. I mean, that's a factual statement. It's not a philosophical statement. If they had chosen to take a different street, they wouldn't have got hit by the drunk driver. You can't say it's their fault because they didn't know that, etc. They didn't have the information, so it wasn't like a conscious decision to get hit by the drunk driver.
Well, but that's the element of chance.
Well, but I think it doesn't. Anything, it just relates to how much consciousness we choose to have of our existence. No, at the level of we decide our level of involvement, because at some level we're conscious of everything.
I'm not going there. I'm not going to say that. Subconsciously we're all basically psychic and agree to something beforehand.
Well, but psychic, I mean, then that's just a word for something that, if everybody's psychic, then the word psychic doesn't mean anything. I mean, it's a difficult concept. I'm not sure if I can express it because I'm still working it out, but it seems to me that if what we call the unconscious, when we're in it, you know, when we're asleep and dreaming, for example, it's not the unconscious, is it? It's only when we come out of it and we forget it that then we call it the unconscious. So it's only in our very narrow identity framework that we have this luxury of the unconscious. It seems that when we're outside that little box of the identity, then that nothing is unconscious, potentially. So it's like you were talking about the multiple personalities before. At some level, there's a self, if you will, or a consciousness that includes all the other little compartmentalized areas of consciousness. But that's been my experience, for what it's worth. And it would make sense if we're all interconnected as an organism, as the universe. If individual humans are cells in the body of humanity, and humanity is part of the earth, and if the earth is a cell in the nervous system of the galaxy, the Milky Way, and so on, which, I don't know, does that sound like mysticism to you, or does that sound like science? Because to me, that's science.
Yeah. Yeah, I know what you're saying.
I don't know if it is science, you tell me, but that's...
Right. Oh, I mean, we had talked about that before, and we had talked about the fact that, you know, science and religion both converge at the point to where matter created itself out of nothing. You know, I mean, because when you really go back, I mean, that's the beginning point, you know, for everything. I mean, scientists are going to call it Big Bang, and religious people are going to call it creation. Matter just kind of created itself out of nothing.
We assume it could also always have been here, or it could never have existed. It may be all Maya, as the Hindus say. There may be no such thing as matter. You see, because I mean, if you take a physical body and go to subatomic level, then you've got all these atoms, no, moving around each other like planets in space, but it's mostly space in the body, yeah.
Right,
and then if you go into the atom, you've got these electrons, neutrons, and protons moving around. It's same story. It's mostly space. So then, what happens if you go into the electrons, protons? I think, again, this is partly based on experience, you know, sort of experimentations of consciousness, not scientific research, but still, I think that you can keep on doing that, going deeper and deeper into matter, and the same phenomenon will occur again and again. So what that means is that every particle is actually mostly space, with these other the tiny particles moving around in space, and so, but you keep, that happens ad infinitum. Each particle is actually just space, so that means there are no particles at all. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Because if every particle is made up of particles that are made up of particles that is, you know, surrounded by space, then there's no particle at all. It's some sort of structure that it's like consciousness has created this structure that creates the illusion of matter, of physical existence, of objects and identity. But as soon as you start plumbing the depths, it's the rabbit hole. You just keep on going down. And
I understand that, and I really appreciate the theory. You know, I like it. That, you know, as above, so below, and the microcosm and macrocosms are, you know, reflective of each other, and we don't know where one ends and where one begins. And I like that, you know, to explore ideas like that. And at the same time, I can't walk through my door, so there's matter. You know, if I wanted to walk through my front door without opening it, I would run into it, right?
Well, sure, but isn't that just a habit?
You know? Forgetting to open the front door?
I mean, how do you know that if you honestly could assimilate this knowledge and claim it and experience it, how do you know that you wouldn't be able to walk through the door?
Yeah, I mean, theoretically, I guess, I don't know, it'd be possible. We're going into the Matrix idea here, right?
I guess. I mean, the Matrix is, it's not just it's not as simple as everything being illusion. I mean, the reason I brought this up, apparently, was this idea that everything is actually conscious, and that consciousness is everywhere. And so the idea of an identity depends on actually isolating a fragment of consciousness so that it's unconscious of everything else that's not itself. And so this is a sort of paradox, that what we think of as consciousness really is unconsciousness, that what we call self-consciousness is only possible by becoming unconscious of what we truly are, which is simply the universe, or beyond. Who knows if the universe is also a cell in a greater body? It probably does go on forever, but for now, you know, our frame of reference is the universe. And as I say, that is scientifically, I don't know about verifiable, but it's comprehensible. We can understand that just using our rational mind, that the universe is organic to some extent, and it's a living system, and we're all part of that system, and that system is aware. So I'm getting all tangled up in my own thought processes now.
Yeah, I understand your I understand it. I agree with it. I mean, I know that we are. It's just an endless system of systems.
So, you know, where does the Messiah complex come into this, you see? I would say that, you know, to try and tie it in with that when an individual self has an inkling of being the totality, that actually you're not Carrie, I'm not Aeolus, we are, as individuals, all of us, we are the universe, the totality of creation. And so, but when the individual self, the identity, has a glimpse of that, then of course it becomes inflated to infinity, and it perceives itself as messianic. And it is, of course. You become God. You have an inkling of being God. And an individual who can actually hold that awareness and not completely lose their marbles would be the Messiah. Or a number of individuals would be the collective Messiah. You know, because that would be the process by which the universe becomes conscious of itself through, in this case, the planet Earth. Presumably it's happening all over the universe. And presumably, if I'm right, then the evolutionary goal of the universe would be to become fully aware of itself, you know, everywhere, throughout its entire organism. And who knows, you know, maybe Earth is, it feels like Earth is the key joint in the whole circuit board, but then it would feel like that to us. It may just be one other planet among millions where this is happening. But it does seem to be happening. And, I mean, you talk about the 100th monkey thing. I mean, my feeling, my intuition very strongly is that it's neither possible nor desirable for the whole of humanity to awaken to their messianic potential as avatars of the universal mind. It's only necessary and only possible for a select few individuals to do so. But that's enough, because that will then create the chain reaction, which will pull everyone else along. And as I see it, the select few, such as they are, would be like the head of a snake, and then the rest of humanity would be the tail, which of course the snake is mostly tail.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's just a question of the of having consciousness, having a having the momentum or the what needs leaders, basically. I mean, it's as simple as that, isn't it? It's what you're talking about. Pioneers would also be leaders. They're not just discovering the new land, they're then leading the tribe into that promised land.
Right.
So that would be the conscious part of the snake, of humanity. See, the bulk of humanity is the tail, and that's it's alive, but it's not conscious. Only the head is conscious. And that I would see that as, you know, your dream of the UFOs is relating to this, is that humanity is becoming becoming zombies because there's they're rejecting this consciousness that they know will destroy them, and so they're taking refuge in the lowest possible consciousness they can find. But that frees up all this consciousness for these select few who know what to do with it. So that would be why the angels were laughing at you, because there's no way, nor is there any reason to save humanity. It doesn't need being saved. Its function has been fulfilled, and something else is taking its place. I don't know. I'm now interpreting your dream for you.
No, it's an interesting interpretation. But, I don't know.
Blue fire, what makes me think of is Uranus, which is the planet that rules over the alien experiences. It's the planet of awakening and the planet of freedom, also the gateway to the abyss. So they all relate to what I've been talking about. But Uranus also rules electricity and is blue. It's also blue. So what came out of your mouth was kind of like electricity, you know, blue fire.
Yeah.
So, I mean, if you were then embodying the alien at that point, then you wouldn't have been able to save humanity because you would already move beyond humanity. And so you wouldn't have even been able to speak because what came out would be some whole new language. I don't know, I'm just going off because...
No, that is interesting. I mean, I've never thought about that, that the blue sparks and the blue flame. I always just assumed that it was some type of... it was scrambling my language, but I never really thought about the fact that it could be a different language altogether, and that I had, you know, evolved somehow to speak a different language.
That was how I understood it when you described it. That was your power. You'd open your mouth because the word is power to the sorcerer. That's how he creates reality, and that, you know, the word of the magus is how a new cycle is begun. Magically speaking, the Messiah is the magus who is powerful enough to speak the word of the Aeon when total silence comes, which is, and in total silence the old system collapses, you know, the collective mind collapses in that silence, and so there's a blank slate in which no one can even think, and so the magus is the one who's powerful enough to actually speak in that silence, and then that first word creates the new. It's the first, as it were, the first intent of the new reality, the new Jerusalem. That's how I understand it. So, words are power, the ultimate power there. And that was you. I would guess you not recognizing your power and expecting a word to come out, and perhaps because you were still attached to the personal, your personal desire to save humanity or to be a messiah. Maybe they're both the same thing, I don't know. What do you think? Did you actually want to save these robot people? I mean, what was your...
I don't know. I mean, it was a dream years and years ago, but I don't really recall thinking about what my intent was in the dream when I woke up.
But were you upset by not being able to save them, or just frustrated?
Oh, sure. Yeah, I was upset. I mean, but it wasn't just... I don't think being upset just because I couldn't save them. I think more I was upset at the whole situation. The whole thing you know, I was more upset at the whole, the entirety of the situation and the fact that the whole thing had come about in the first place. Not just that I couldn't save them.
Right.
You know, but just me being placed in the position, the fact that everyone had apparently turned to zombies or was getting sucked into the earth, you know, the whole thing irritates me.
And the fact that the angels were kind of making fun of you.
Yeah, you know, they weren't helping. They definitely weren't helping, you know, they were just kind of watching it happen.
So, I mean, how do you feel now about the idea of humanity needing saving, and is it something that you feel a responsibility for?
Oh, absolutely not. Yeah, absolutely not. I've become, I don't know, I guess you could say, I'm just really, really disappointed in people in general. More so than when I was young, of course, when I was having all these dreams. But let's see, you know, with the election going on and everything, I hear people, so many people say the most ridiculous things now. And of course, we're having a financial crisis.
Yeah.
A terrible, terrible election experience. I mean, it's just a bad time right now. Just, you know, I don't want to talk to anybody. That's why I think sometimes whenever you and I get on here to talk, I'm just like, man, I don't even want to say anything. Just keep my mouth shut.
That hasn't happened.
Yeah, I know. Well, you and I talked in private about, you know, some of the things that happened over the last few weeks. And you know what? I'm just going to just speak the truth and just not really worry about it. You know, anybody listening who thinks I'm completely and totally nuts is welcome to. You know, I just hope they don't try to find out where I live and come and burn my house down to get the witch or whatever. I mean,
not too lightly, I think. I think we should probably wind up here, Carrie, because we've got a lot of good material, and it's a nightmare to edit this stuff.
I'm sure. Let me tell you one more thing.
Yeah.
Because this involves, I had a dream last week that involves vampires and your book. That hasn't come out yet, but, you know, of course, I've read it. I was in a high-rise, a penthouse, like a really nice place, like New York or something, and I was talking to this guy. I don't remember what we were talking about, and there was two women in the background, and I sat here talking about this to this guy about something, and I looked at one of the women, and her eyes looked really strange, and I was like, uh-oh, they're not humans. And as soon as I thought that, they all got in my head and started doing mind scans on me. And, kind of freaked me out, so I ran out on the patio to get it in the sunlight, because for some reason I was thinking they were vampires. And, you know, they came to the window and they wouldn't step into the sunlight, so I'm out on this patio like 5 feet from them, and they're like talking to me. And they said the guy was kind of speaking for me. He said something interesting. He said, well, you know, we read your mind and we know what you think about us, because we have fallen so far from God, we're so far into matter now that, you know, we can't be saved. And I told him, you know, that I said, well, I couldn't help but be initially frightened, you know, and maybe even you may have detected me being repulsed in my mind, but that's just instinct. And then I started almost reciting Homo Sapiens and how you kind of explain the descent in the matter. I started telling this main vampire guy that, well, you know, you can't really ever get away from God, and you're never really beyond redemption, because you're always going to be a piece of God, no matter how small, and you just can't get away from it.
What did he say to that?
They kind of got real calm and just kind of looked at me like, wow, that's, I don't know, it just kind of took them by surprise.
Nice dream.
Kinda like, yeah, and they were just kind of looking at me like, whoa, what just happened? You know, when I woke up and I was thinking about it, I was like, it's like, hey, I know someone who would like this dream. Especially because the idea seemed to really please them. They had, you know, they seemed like they had never thought of that or considered that before.
Well, maybe that's your role as savior, Carrie. You're going to be saviors not of humanity, but of the fallen Nosferatu.
Yeah. Yeah, it's odd that you say that, because that's one of the weird things that sometimes I think, is that I'm not really a savior. I'm just going to kind of be like a bridge.
To, from, for?
Reconciling apparently irreconcilable opposites.
good and evil. Bringing good and evil together, Christ and Lucifer walking down the aisle to holy wedded bliss.
Yep.